Hey, welcome back. It is Downtown on a Wednesday afternoon. Rich Kimball with you. And Bruce Pratt here as well for this week's edition of Sports Lit 101, a book that we've talked about a couple of times. We're very excited to talk to the author. Her name is Emily Ruth Rutter. She is an associate professor of English and the assistant director of African American Studies at Ball State University, the author of Invisible Ball of Dreams, Literary Representations of Baseball Behind the Color Line, The Blues Muse, Race, Gender, and Musical Celebrity in American Poetry, and her newest, which is Black Celebrity, Contemporary Representations of Postbellum Athletes and Artists. Emily, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Well, this is such a very interesting book and an interesting period of history. What was it that drew you to this time and the story behind it?
Well, the first two books you named there are both about kind of literary understandings or literary representations, you might say, of historical figures or kind of Black cultural history. So one about baseball in the Jim Crow era, particularly the Negro Leagues, and the other one about literary representations of blues icons. So this is kind of, Black Celebrity is kind of the third in a trilogy that looks back to, you know, the kind of Reconstruction era. So before those blues icons, you know, before that Harlem Renaissance period, and also before the era of the Negro League. So kind of went back a bit further than those first two books to kind of think about how Black athletes and artists and entertainers, their experiences and the way that those experiences kind of mapped out a playbook that we can still see at work today.
One of the things I noticed, Emily, is that, or it made me think about, was how invisible to modern culture a lot of those people that you talked about are. I mean, I think of myself as a pretty good blues historian and musical historian. I had no idea about Blind Tom Wiggins. You know, I mean, it never crossed my radar. So, A, how did you sort of discover those people, and what made you want to focus on people like him particularly?
Thanks for that, Bruce. Yeah, similarly, I think I had stumbled on a reference to Blind Tom maybe once or twice before reading these two literary texts, you know, but didn't have any real knowledge of his life or the body of his work. So, I mean, as somebody who's a literary critic or a literary and cultural critic, I sort of let these literary texts lead the way. So it just so happened that I hosted the poet Tyhemba Jess, and right after he won the Pulitzer Prize in 2017, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for his poetry collection Olio, which is the book that kind of I described as creatively recuperating Blind Tom. And then I also read a novel by Jeffrey Allen, a contemporary novelist, about Blind Tom as well, called Song of the Shank. And so that really, those two works are really what were the kind of like beginning of this book, Black Celebrity. Because I, you know, two contemporary authors, very acclaimed contemporary authors, writing about the same figure, right? And trying to understand what the world was like for a man who was blind and likely autistic and who never really gained his freedom, even after emancipation. He was still kind of controlled by the Bethune family who had, quote-unquote, owned his, you know, him and his family before the Civil War. And so he never really gained his freedom, but at the same time, he was this international celebrity. So that paradox, right, to be both subjected, both in subjugated and subjected to this, you know, really relentless kind of white control and white gaze, but then also be, you know, somebody who was acclaimed throughout the world as this virtuoso pianist. That paradox really fascinated me. And again, I think you can kind of, you know, one of the things I do in the book is kind of trace the through line, you know, to the contemporary era. And I think you can see that same kind of paradox at work today. Obviously, it's different. Obviously, Black celebrities have far more agency than someone like Blind Tom. But at the same time, you know, the way in which the white gaze still kind of, you know, controls a lot of the athletic and entertainment arenas, but also, you know, that Black celebrities or especially athletes and artists and entertainers are kind of hyper visible. That, you know, that seems to be a kind of parallel with the past.
One of the things I found fascinating in the book was, and I think Michelle Schiavone had also said something about this to me, is that, you know, there are certain people we keep reimagining or we keep needing to rediscover because we never get a full handle on them. I think of Jack Johnson as being probably of all the sports figures that I know anything about, the one that I maybe know the least about. It's so hard to unravel. And I thought you did a fabulous job by looking at him through that older lens. Do you have to apply sort of different techniques to do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, Jack Johnson has the theorist Joseph Roach calls it an it quality, right?
Yeah.
It's like hard to describe exactly what it is, but yeah, he has it. And I mean, I think one of the things that I tried to do here is put a bunch of different sources alongside one another, right? So lyric poetry, archival accounts, even the photograph of him on the cover,
yeah.
Right, where he's wearing the fur coat and hat and the bow tie, and like he's just such a dapper dresser, you know, and that was part of his celebrity too. So just sort of putting a lot of different imagined voices alongside these historical accounts, alongside Johnson's own autobiographies, you know, and there's kind of a way, I think, of using, if you use multiple sources, some of them imagined, you know, some of them more traditional kind of historical resources, then I think you can get at a semblance of the truth, right? But you have to, especially with marginalized figures and thinking about these marginalized histories, I think that's what we have to do. We have to, you know, approach them from a variety of different angles and utilize a variety of different kinds of sources in order to kind of cobble together, you know, a version of history that's not overdetermined by a kind of master narrative.
I thought it was very interesting, too, whether it was Jack Johnson or Joe Louis, Muhammad Ali, in more recent times, that to be able to reach beyond the African-American world, athletes and artists had to be what's called the right kind of black.
Right. Absolutely. And Jack Johnson certainly was not the right kind of black, right? Which is, I think is another kind of reason he has that it quality. Because he flouted those kinds of the expectations of the white gaze or, you know, white power structures. And so I think that kind of defiance, and Muhammad Ali is similar, right? That kind of defiance makes them these sort of larger than life icons. And yet they really paid a price for that, you know, in terms of their personal lives. I mean, somebody like Jack Johnson, obviously first black heavyweight, but then, you know, he's harassed by law enforcement, FBI, you know, he has to do kind of degrading sorts of performances towards the end of his life just to scrape by. And so, you know, that kind of the way that defiance, but then also the way that the kind of dominant power structures never let them forget it. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, Emily, the other thing I was thinking that this book really allowed me to think about again in a way I haven't in a long time, is that there's a notion in society that black people were totally unsuccessful until sometime in the middle of the last century, that nobody really succeeded at anything, and no appreciation for the incredible things that were accomplished by athletes and artists and businessmen and the like. And I'm wondering if you think that a lot of that had to do because so many of them were punished for being successful. Or, you know, I think of the Tulsa massacre. I think of what happened to Johnson. I think of the way Ali was treated. How much of that do you think maybe there was a downplaying of African American success?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the things that you know, we can think about in terms of the politics of history, right? That the more that it's not it accidental that these stories are shunted to the side, or that, you know, kind of like dominant media doesn't pick them up and share them with us, or they're not taught in schools or whatever, because there is a kind of power and empowerment in knowing your history And so when these figures, you know, when somebody like a Jack Johnson, or, you know, I mean, we can think of some of these other figures, even like Christine and Millie McCoy, you know, or Isaac Burns Murphy, or some of the other figures that I look at in the book, that their stories are really inspirational and they're empowering. And so, you know, if we want things to sort of, if the dominant power structure kind of wants things to stay the same, they don't necessarily want to, you know, circulate those stories of empowerment. And so I do think that what you're raising is a good point. You know, we need to attend more to the late 19th century, the post-Civil War era Reconstruction, and afterwards, and sort of recuperate those figures. And we also need to think about why that those figures' memories haven't become part of, you know, our sort of mainstream understanding of American history. Because, you know, this is everybody's history, right? Black history is American history. And so it's important that we all know these stories. And I think there's, you know, a reason why they aren't circulated more widely. And that can be a kind of lesson for us in the present.
We're talking with Emily Rutter. Her book is Black Celebrity. Well, I love the point you just made, because I'm a full-time high school history teacher. And of course, in the world of education, you know, we're under assault, because
absolutely,
to try and correct the record that's out there, there's certainly a segment of the population that believes we're creating an alternate history, or in somehow making less of the success of white people, or blaming people for what might have happened along the way. And yes, there's an element of that, and it's deserved, but also it's trying to tell the history of all of America. And for too long, that's not the history that students have been taught.
That's right. And I think, you know, there's kind of two parts to that. So on the one hand, it's certainly in order to sort of be able to look proudly at yourself in the present and think towards the future, you need to understand your past. So that's certainly really important for Black students and students of color more generally. But it also is important for white students, right? Understand where they place themselves in this society and, you know, our sort of implication and responsibilities in the present and future. We also need to understand our history. And so it's an impoverishment of educational history for both and all groups, I guess, you know. So it's not about blame. It's about understanding,
right,
and facing,
right,
and reckoning with our truth in order to map out a different kind of future.
Emily, one of the things I've always wanted to ask you, and it is, what first drew you to this academic pursuit? And I don't want to use the word academic just in that sort of college professor thing, but what led you to take this whole idea of this trilogy of books to the page? What got you to move it there? What was the driving force?
Yeah, I guess I've always been really interested in the connection between art and history and power. You know, I've always been very invested in politics, and certainly, you know, in art and literature. And it's just helped, I'll just say on a personal level, it's really helped me to understand the history of this country and my places in it. And so, and I really feel like I've done that in a lot of ways through literature and my relationship with literature. And so it that kind of self-understanding, I guess, led me to think about, you know, what that might allow for others. And, you know, I'm a teacher too, and so doing that in the classroom with students, and then of course, like with my colleagues, you know, in conferences and whatnot, it's helped me to kind of come to reckon with some things. And so I try in my book to facilitate that for others. And, you know, I mean, I think also like the things I take up in terms of sports or music and, you know, entertainment more generally, and those are things that I consume, right? Mm. I mean, I'm a person who likes sports and I certainly, you know, like music and entertainment. And so it's like, I'm a consumer of these things. And so as a consumer, I guess I want to be an educated one who's kind of thinking about what I'm bringing, the histories I'm bringing and the gaze I'm bringing to that consumption. And again, it's helpful for me to try to facilitate that for others as well, to kind of bring us into a community of of viewers or, you know, people engaged with the consumption of popular culture in a way that, you know, is interrogating the ideologies that have shaped it.
You know, as the arc of music particularly, is, if you look at it from the early 20th century till now, I mean, there was a time when the bulk of records made by African-American performers were what we called at the time, what were called at the time race records. The majority of the consumers were also African-American. Somewhere along the line, when white people began to be more interested in consuming that product and records started to cross racial boundaries, do you think that there was anything lost in that in terms of African-American culture?
That's interesting. I mean, I think that is a good question to think about with like all of these kinds of, you know, forms of cultural production. So, you know, I think that's a question that's often asked of Black baseball as well. You know, what was lost with integration, for example? That's a pretty live question. So, I mean, I do think that if we look at the music and sports today, you know, we can say that what African Americans sort of might have lost or are still trying to rest or regain is ownership.
Right.
So, you know, Bill Roden has that wonderful phrase, I mean, not wonderful in its implication, but wonderful in its phrasing, $40 million slave. Think talking about, you know, contemporary Black athletes. And so it's just that idea that, like, the people that sort of own music and the people that control music, generally speaking, and sports, generally speaking, are white, even though, you know, the musicians and athletes are often Black. So there's a kind of replication of, you know, some really kinds of pernicious hierarchies there. So I mean, I think that's a live question. I mean, it's so complicated, right? because there's always been crossover, and there, you know, a lot of musicians and athletes, of course, want a multiracial audience. And so, I mean, there's just so many layers to it. But I think, like, at the heart of your question is, you know, that it's power, and the question's about power, and, you know, being able to control your own kind of message and circulation and all of that.
It's a powerful book, and I think an important one as well, Black Celebrity, Contemporary Representations of Postbellum Athletes and Artists. Emily Ruth Rutter, the author. Emily, thank you so much for visiting with us today.
Thank you so much. This was so fun. Yeah, thanks for having me.
It was fun. We'll have you back.
Thanks, Bruce. All right. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, hope I see you in Victoria, British Columbia in June.
Absolutely.